Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the Trump administration's tax overhaul plan from the former chief of staff of the U.S. Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation, Edward Kleinbart. Now a professor of law at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law, he joins us to discuss his article at Vox.com. The GOP says its business plan will help workers and small businesses. It won't. And the cynical way Republicans are trying to sell this latest giveaway to the 1% of the 1%, claiming it will help the middle class and working Americans. And while this so-called tax reform is clearly a gift to the donor class by the Republicans, these lackeys of the plutocrats are counting on satisfying their political masters by conning their voters into believing they are getting the government off their back, when in fact Trump and the Congress are making ordinary Americans shoulder more of the tax burden so that the already rich can get even richer. Then we'll speak with one of the country's leading experts on taxation who, because of his investigative journalism, has been called the nation's de facto tax enforcer-in-chief. Pulitzer Prize winner David K. Johnston, the founder and editor-in-chief of DCReport.com, whose latest book is The Making of Donald Trump, joins us to discuss how the soulless hirelings of the rich in Congress are trotting out the same tired old trickle-down lies and the real possibility that Donald Trump could be the first American president to do a perp walk in an orange jumpsuit on his way from the Oval Office to a federal penitentiary. Then finally, we will speak with Natalie Hernandez, a Nevada gun violence prevention organizer with Battle Born Progress, a part of a coalition of gun safety activists who successfully passed Question 1 on last November's ballot, only to have the law stymied and the will of the people trampled on by Nevada's Attorney General Adam Laxalt. We will discuss what impact the massacre in Las Vegas on Sunday might have on finally instituting the background check law and whether Adam Laxalt will be punished in his expected race for governor in the 2018 elections. And joining us now is Edward Kleinbart, a professor of law at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law. His work focuses on the taxation of capital income, international tax issues, and the political economy of taxation, including the intersection of tax policy and contemporary politics. He served as chief of staff of the United States Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation, and his latest book is We Are Better Than This, How Government Should Spend Our Money. And he has an op-ed at Vox. The GOP says its business tax plan will help workers and small businesses. It won't. Welcome to Background Briefing, Edward Kleinbart.
Ian, thanks very much. And just for everyone's benefit, I want to make sure that they understand that the op-ed is at Vox.com and not at Fox.com.
Well, I doubt whether Fox would run something that you wrote that was in any way critical. They are the Pravda of the Republican Party, the cheer squad of the Trump administration. It's pretty shameless that we have alternative universes in our media in this country where the people who get fake news believe it, and they believe that the media that actually publishes real news is fake news. So I think that's an issue we could discuss forever. But let's talk about this tax plan. Initially, Steve Mnuchin and Gary Cohn waived a two-page tax reform plan, and that was absurd and laughable. Now it's up to 8 pages. The details are coming out from the Tax Policy Institute, I guess, are the leaders in this. But my sense, Ed, is that what this really tells us is that the Congress, and the Republicans in particular, are really serving their donors and trying to con their voters. And do you think they're going to get away with it?
Well, I guess the first question is, do I agree with that assessment? And you know, unfortunately, I have to agree that this is, first, the so-called framework, the 8 or 9 page document, is barely more than the 2 page document, actually 1 page, as I think about it, that was offered a few months ago. Virtually no progress has been made in terms of nailing down a specific proposal, which in the ordinary case would have been accompanied by a revenue estimate and a distributional analysis to see who benefits and who loses. None of that work has been done. But the only thing that you can say with certainty is that the framework, as they call it, that's been proposed delivers the vast preponderance of its tax cut benefits to the most affluent Americans. That is incontestable.
And Donald Trump himself, I believe, would benefit to the tune of about $1 billion.
Well, yes, it's difficult to tell exactly how much he would benefit because he hasn't released his tax returns, but we know that he will benefit because Donald J. Trump Enterprises is a constellation of about 500 so-called pass-through entities where the ultimate owners are taxed, not the businesses themselves, which means Donald Trump and his family. And the framework creates a special sort of tax forgiveness bracket for high-income pass-through business owners at a 25% rate instead of the 39.6 or the 35%, whatever the top rate ends up being. So the only people who care about this new special bracket for pass-through business owners are people with incomes, married, filing joint, over about $234,000 a year, because up to that point, the tax brackets would be 25% in any case. So you're talking about people making hundreds of thousands or millions or tens of millions of dollars a year through their ownership of capital, through being rich and having capital invested in businesses. It's those owners who would benefit from that pass-through rate.
And, of course, the other big lie that they put forth is, again, this idea of getting rid of the estate tax. And they brought up the idea of small businesses and farmers being put out of business by the estate tax. Go ahead.
And, you know, Ian, we're way past the era where a farm means 40 acres and a mule. That's just not the farming industry in America today. Farming is not necessarily a small business activity. The vast bulk of production is a big business activity. And to the extent it's a small business, well, the estate tax today allows a married couple effectively to pass $11 million of value to their heirs tax-free, from the first to die spouse to the second to die spouse, to kids, $11 million goes tax free. That's a pretty good sized small business right there, as to which the estate tax simply does not apply.
So, and of course, there just isn't any evidence, or there's some evidence, I believe, of some family farms, but I think it's less than 80 from what I've read.
It's a very small number. The number of decedents, the dead folks, you know, whose estates owe estate tax every year is in four figures. It's not even in five figures. It's, you know, 4,000 or 5,000, 6,000 estates a year that actually owe estate tax. The estate tax is a way of asking for some reinvestment in the larger economy by the very most successful and to some extent the very luckiest families in America. It's a tax on the 0.1%, not even the 1%.
And again, I'm speaking with Edward Kleinbart, Professor of Law at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law. His work focuses on the taxation of capital income, international tax issues, and the political economy of taxation, including the intersection of tax policy and contemporary politics. He served as Chief of Staff of the U.S. Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation, and his latest book is We Are Better Than This, How Government Should Spend Our Money. And he has an op-ed at Vox.com. The GOP says its business tax plan will help workers and small businesses. It won't. So I guess, again, going back to my sense that this is really about how the Congress is basically doing the bidding of the donor class.
Yes.
And trying to con the people who voted for them into believing that they're actually going to get a tax break. And some of the figures I've read from the analysis coming from the Nonpartisan Tax Policy Center, I think working Americans would get back an average of $60. Is that right? It's, I mean,
yes.
It's ludicrous.
So the only reliable data that we have on the distributional implications of the bill, of the proposal, is the work of the Tax Policy Center. This is just a complete dereliction of duty by the administration to put out something that they call a tax proposal without any of the backup of what it would actually mean to people. But the Tax Policy Center has done so and has found that for most Americans, they will get either very small reductions in tax bills or an increase in tax bills. At every turn, there's a significant minority at every bracket level, basically, particularly in the low six-figure range. There's a significant minority, which means millions of people, who will find their taxes going up rather than down. But when you get to the very top, well, then everybody joins hands and enjoys gigantic benefits. I think the Tax Policy Center numbers are something on the order of 4/5 of the benefits go to the very most affluent.
And this, of course, will blow a hole in the debt and the deficit.
And that's why we should care. You know, there's this argument out there that to focus on the most affluent means that you one is just engaging in an exercise in envy. And that's false. Precisely for the reason you just said, Ian, precisely because this framework would vastly increase the deficit is the reason why we all should care. Increasing the deficit, in fact, is an anti-growth direction. It's going to hurt future growth, not help future growth, because that deficit has to be financed with more government borrowing, which raises interest rates for everybody. And that deficit is ultimately going to have to, is ultimately paid, and it's going to be paid in the form of higher taxes on a future generation. So it's not an exercise in envy to suggest that all of us have reason not to want to raid the Treasury for the benefit of the donor class.
Well, the deficit hawks, Republican deficit hawks, who were ranting about Obama's running up the debt to $20 trillion, now they're being incredibly silent. So are there any Republicans that are sticking to their principles in terms
of... I think you're absolutely right that what we have seen is that the deficit hawks have flapped their wings and flown away. And what we're left with is a stunning silence on the part of thoughtful of any kind of Republican leadership on an issue which is one that under traditional Republican policies and philosophies ought to be front and center. So it's extremely disheartening to see sort of the collapse of any kind of a intellectual honesty or coherence to one of our two major political parties. That's bad for America, you know. It's to have a political party that is simply a shill for a donor class is just not good for America. There are reasons to be a fiscal hawk. There are reasons to worry about is government spending too much money or not. We can all come out with different places, but if all you're going to do is run for Congress and then be a shill for the donor class and unfortunately for the NRA. Well, that's not a political party, you know. That's just a agent of a particular small fraction of the citizenry.
Well, indeed, I think you could make the case that only a handful of billionaires dominate our politics. The Koch brothers certainly have an undue influence over the House, and the only agenda that the House has gotten done since Trump came into office has been effectively the Koch brothers' agenda, crippling the EPA, opening up the tar sands pipeline, opening up offshore oil drilling, etc. And then on the executive branch side, another billionaire, the Mercer's family, are the biggest donors to Trump. And they equally, along with Peter Thiel, have this kind of libertarian idea that you basically don't need government. Get them out of the way. So at the end of the day, what kind of America would it be if the plutocrats got their way? It would seem to me that at the end of the day, the only government service would be the police protecting the mansions of the plutocrats against the mobs outside the gates.
It does. It reminds me of Venezuela. And it is extraordinary that so many millions of voters do not appreciate that that is the implication. Again, I'm not suggesting that everyone has to have the same values that I do, but I am suggesting that you need a political party with some intellectual honesty and coherence and philosophy on one side of issues, how big should government be, and another political party on the other fundamental issue of how big should government be. And they should work, you know, thrash it out each year and come to some consensus conclusions. And that's just fallen apart, And that's really too bad.
Well, you would think that there'd be a little bit of buyer's remorse amongst the people who voted for Trump. And many were just frustrated and angry at government and didn't like Hillary Clinton. There's a hardcore group, of course, that seemed to be completely in the Fox News, Breitbart, Sinclair, Rush Limbaugh bubble that believe everything else out there is fake news and only what Fox tells them, et cetera, is the truth. I think that number is eventually going to go down. But what is it, though, explains that apparent gullibility, that this snake oil salesman who's only been out for himself his entire life, it's so obvious when you see him, at, for example, down in Puerto Rico, no empathy for the people of Puerto Rico. All the time he's talking about himself and what a great guy he is and what a great job he's doing, all of which is absolutely ludicrous. But it's just extraordinarily cynical. And somehow that doesn't penetrate. So what are we dealing with here in terms of working class and middle class Americans voting for plutocrats who rip them off? And is it aspirational politics? Is it clinging to this notion that you too can be a millionaire somehow? This is like the political equivalent of winning the lottery.
It's very difficult, you know, for me to answer that question, except that there seems to be a consistent sort of view that government's good for nothing, that we've lost sight of the fact that government, in fact, can be useful. And if you start from the view that government is a bunch of good-for-nothing leeches sucking away your hard-earned money, then it's easy to sort of fall into some of the rhetorical traps to believe somehow that by cutting corporate taxes that will lead to growth for the middle class and so on, which the conservative organization, like the Committee for Responsible Federal Budget, has just put out a thought piece demonstrating how false that particular line of reasoning is. And so really the failure, I think, is one of understanding what government is good for. And for those Americans who have been successful in a financial sense, we have somehow lost sight of the role of luck in our lives. We believe that whatever we earn, if it's millions of dollars, represents a decision by the universe to give us our due because we are that special. And in fact, life is full of moments of luck that have material impact on our lives. And that's one of the great roles of government, is to mitigate the random distribution of bad luck. And once you lose that sense of empathy with other fellow Americans, which is made more forceful by the realization of how important luck is in our lives, once you lose sight of that and think that everything reflects your own merit, and you lose empathy for your fellow Americans, then it's easy to conclude that government exists simply to leech money away from one. I think it's some kind of dynamic along those lines.
Well, Edward Kleinblatt, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Edward Kleinbart, a professor of law at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law. His work focuses on the taxation of capital income, international tax issues, and the political economy of taxation, including the intersection of tax policy and contemporary politics. He served as chief of staff of the U.S. Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation, and his latest book is We Are Better Than This, How Government Should Spend Our Money, and he has an op-ed at Vox.com. The GOP says its business tax plan will help workers and small businesses. It won't. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with Pulitzer Prize winner David K. Johnson, the founder and editor-in-chief of DCReport.org.
If I were a rich man, all day long I bidi-bidi-bum. If I were a wealthy man, I wouldn't have to work hard. If I were a bitty rich, idle diddle 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 man, I'd build.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is David K. Johnson, an investigative journalist and winner of the Pulitzer Prize for Journalism, a longtime reporter for The New York Times, and the former president of the Investigative Reporters and Editors. He's the author of several New York Times bestsellers, including Perfectly Legal and Free Lunch. He has won the IRE Medal and a George Polk Award for his investigative reporting. And he recently co-founded and is the editor-in-chief of DC Report. And his latest book is The Making of Donald Trump. Welcome to Background Briefing, David K. Johnson.
Well, Ian, thank you for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure, David. And I find it extraordinary that I just was watching Donald Trump in Nevada, and he was with some medical staff, and then he later met with the police and first responders. But standing there with the medical staff, a reporter managed to ask him, obviously, about gun control and having a debate, and he immediately shut that down, saying the time is not right. But then somebody shouted about Rex Tillerson's remarks that Donald Trump is a moron. And he, of course, said that's fake news. That's NBC. It's fake news.
But right, even though Tillerson doesn't deny that he said it.
Right, but isn't it an amazing situation to have the president of the United States effectively in a position where he has to answer, have you now or have you ever been a moron? I mean, what an extraordinary turn of events.
Well, you know, a moron in the sense Tillerson meant it, somebody who has no idea what they're doing, is in fact an accurate description of Donald. I've often said that if you didn't know who he was and he didn't have all his wealthy trappings and you sat down next to him at a hotel bar or a neighborhood bar, within 15, 20 minutes, you would conclude, this guy's a crazy blowhard. And that he has managed to get where he is tells you a lot about how deeply our democracy is in trouble, about how the people who put him in office, a minority of Americans to be sure, but how they have been so abused by the leaders of both political parties now for decades, which is what I wrote Perfectly Legal, the Fine Print and Free Lunch about, that they'll turn to anybody who they think will help them. And, you know, I get emails all the time about Donald is our savior. Ian, my favorite is from a woman in Indiana. Mr. Johnston, now that we have a fine Christian man of integrity in the family man of integrity in the White House, not one of those things is true, but there are people who believe this.
And how long do you think that 35% is going to hold? I mean, because every day in the real world, and maybe the people are in a different alternative universe with Fox, Sinclair, and Breitbart, and Rush Limbaugh, etc. Is it possible that that can hold? It would seem to me that eventually just the weight of the sheer incompetence, the pathetic dog and pony show that goes on every day with this man with unbridled vanity and self-obsession, talking about what a great guy and what great stuff he's doing, and all these promises he's made, none of which have been fulfilled. I don't know how much longer he can hype something that's not happening in the face of serial incompetence.
Well, Ian, I'm trying to make your life miserable here, but if you would spend a week only watching and reading and paying attention to the news sites that you mentioned, plus a few others run by neo-Nazis and racists, I assure you that you would come away saying, oh, Donald Trump is a god. He walks on water. He's being attacked by these leftist journalists who want to bring Sharia law to America. And thank goodness this savior is there trying to help us. And look at the enormously great accomplishments he's achieved. Why, he signed I don't know how many bills, and he certainly knows how to deal with those brown-skinned people from south of the border, et cetera, et cetera. If you get mainstream news, you have a totally different view of Trump than if you follow these mendacious organizations. And that's what they are. They just lie left and right. They have a political agenda, which is perfectly legal under our Constitution. But at the same time, they also accuse everybody who's honest of being dishonest. But there are large numbers of people in this country who they don't believe anything that appears. It doesn't matter if Trump himself says something and says, yeah, that's what I said, they'll still call it fake news or a lie.
So the plutocrats like the Koch brothers and the Mercers and Rupert Murdoch, who apparently speaks to Trump on a daily basis and is something like a mentor father figure, what do they think? Is it okay to have a complete incompetent running the United States? Do plutocrats think that because they're so rich, they're much cleverer, and that they want sort of a dodo or a dotted, as the North Korean leader described him, as their political agent? I mean, is it that cynical that they don't want...
You have to think about the way they would view this. Given the alternative, they would have had Hillary Clinton. They're much happier, and they certainly don't want to see someone like Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker, Al Franken, become the next president, because that's inimical to their financial interests and their view of the world. And one of the things important to keep in mind about people like the Koch brothers, the Koch brothers are have terrible beliefs and want to do what you and I would think are terrible things, but they believe in them. They are not intellectually corrupt. It's very important to understand that, because otherwise you'll never get anywhere. They are actually good managers of their businesses. The value of their businesses keeps going up. People who know them personally find them, as, by the way, I've found some mob guys that I have known to be, just incredibly fascinating and charming. What's important is policy here, and their policies are the problem, not their wealth, not their desire to expand and increase their power. And we need to focus on their policies. And fundamentally, for those sorts of folks, Donald Trump is better than the alternative. So it's like Vladimir Putin. Does Vladimir Putin have some buyer's remorse over getting Donald Trump into the White House, which he clearly did? Of course he does. But he's a lot happier than if Hillary Clinton had been in the White House, because she had made it clear that she was going to put the screws to the Kremlin like nobody ever had, and was going to push their economy down as far as was necessary to get Putin to back out of Crimea and Ukraine.
So then what is their end game? If they want to destroy government, which is what I understand the Kochs are about, and Peter Thiel and the Mercers, they all have that sort of libertarian bent. If they want to basically get rid of government and create a kind of a permanent underclass, won't we reach a point where the only part of government would be the police to protect the mansions of the Kochs, and on the other side of the gates you'll have this roiling mob?
But they don't want to create a permanent underclass. That may well be the product of what they're trying to do. But they want the freedom to pollute, for example. They want to be able to say, we're going to make these products that Americans want, but we're not going to clean up the mess that's required to make them, and we're going to spew it out into the environment, because then we can charge a lower price, or we can charge the same price and earn a larger profit. Their goal is not to create an underclass. It is to get rid of government from all functions except civil law, so they win in contract disputes, so they can take away rights of workers, so they can say, you have to go to arbitration, you can't sue. Police, to protect their property and arrest people who are criminals. And a big military. They don't want to have an environmental protection agency. If 15% of Americans get very good educations, then that's enough for the what they want for their businesses. I mean, they have a very dark view of the world, but it is not a view intended to create poor people. It is a view intended to enhance their power and their belief system, which would produce these things, but that's not their goal.
David K. Johnson, on today's program, you are preceded by Ed Kleinbart, who was the Chief of Staff of the U.S. Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation. And I was talking to him, of course, about the new tax reform, in quotes, plan that was put forth initially. Two pages was waved around by Gary Cohn and Steve Mnuchin. And now they've come up with like about 8 or 9 pages. And it's just so cynical. It seems to me that it's so clear that the Republican Congress and this White House is all about satisfying donors and conning their voters, because this is not going to help the middle class. It's not going to help working Americans.
I totally agree with you, Ian. Ian, I absolutely agree with you about this. It is astonishing. First, they produced what I call the 100-word plan, which is, you know, let me go back in time. Let's remember that Donald Trump in the campaign said no one in the history of the world knows more about taxes than he does. And he said he had a tax plan. Well, of course, Donald doesn't know anything about taxes. I tried to give him tax advice once, and he couldn't follow my tax advice. He didn't have a plan. When they finally come up with a 100-word plan, it's like a shopping list for Goldman Sachs and its clients. Then they come up with this, they call it 9 pages, but take away the cover sheet, it's 8, and it's mostly white space. And again, it's a shopping list for Goldman Sachs with a couple of crumbs thrown off to the middle class. This is a tax plan that would replace the 10% rate with a 12% rate. And they say, well, but a married couple will get $24,000 of income before they pay any taxes. Well, under current law, they get over $20,000 before they pay any taxes. That's no big deal. Then they get rid of the 15% rate. That's where most of the money is raised. And they go to 25. So when you earn your last dollar at 12%, the next dollar will be taxed more than twice as much at 25. And why are they doing this? Because if they can squeeze the middle class and the upper middle class, they can finance tax cuts for the people who are the customers of Goldman Sachs. And this is the most cynical nonsense, and that the American public isn't outraged over this tells you how many Americans have simply said, I can't stand it anymore. I don't care. Doesn't matter. I'm going to get on with my life. Turn on the ball game.
Well, you know, this trickle-down thing, you would think by now had been discredited. It's pretty clear that taking the handcuffs off the millionaires and putting the handcuffs on the welfare queens, as Ronald Reagan promised, ran up the debt. George W. Bush's tax cuts.
So instead we have the welfare king, Donald Trump, who's collected many hundreds of millions of dollars in welfare in the White House. The mythical welfare queen, the one woman who went to prison for having multiple welfare accounts, has made all this policy because of Reagan, and now we have an actual welfare king in the White House, and he's trying to get more welfare for himself and his friends. Astonishing.
Now, and when you talk about welfare, you're talking about these pass-through companies that he's got, what, 500-odd companies that are pass-through?
No. Donald has actually collected money from the taxpayers. He got a $400 million tax break on the Grand Hyatt Hotel, which had no property taxes for 40 years. And when he sold it, the price it was sold for reflected that tax savings. In Palos Verdes, where he has his golf course, he says that it's worth $250-some million, which is nonsense. But he's indicated that he took on his tax return a deduction that, based on his public comments, apparently was $100 million. For the part of the property that is geologically unstable. You know, they have to shut down the loop road down there on the Palos Verdes Peninsula all the time because the earth is moving. And he apparently took a $100 million tax deduction for not being able to develop part of the land that he never would have been able to develop. Well, that's worth $30-some million in taxes to him.
Donald has been, much of Donald's money comes from the taxpayers. Right now, Secret Service agents and other government officials, when they go to his golf courses in Mar-a-Lago, they pay top dollar, and he makes a profit on all of that.
So you were the recipient of Donald Trump's only tax return that was revealed. I think it was 2005. It was dropped off in your mailbox, and it was obviously dropped off by him or his agents. And you were, I think right away you said you were suspected it was Donald Trump himself that had leaked it. And I take it the reason that Donald Trump leaked it was that it was the only tax return that he's released because it was reasonably favorable, right?
Yes. Well, it showed the return was dropped off by my mailman. It was sent through the mail. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty sure it was from Donald or someone he directed because it was a client copy. But here's what's significant about the 2005 return. It showed this enormous income, $152.7 million, $3 million a week. It also showed he paid in both regular income tax and what's called the alternative minimum tax about 24% of his income. But here's the catch. The kind of alternative minimum tax he paid is refundable the next year or in subsequent years. So basically, if we had his returns for 2006, 7, 8, 9, what we would see is he gave this money to the government, $31 million, and then he got it back. That's why you need to see multiple years of tax returns. And I've also shown Ian, you know, that Donald Trump's a tax cheat. I mean, in the making of Donald Trump, I tell about the trial, two trials, over his 1984 income tax return, in which his own tax guy was shown the return. And he looked at it and said, well, that's my signature, but I did not prepare that tax return. His name had been put on with a photocopy machine. And that's evidence of fraud. And Donald Trump, I have no doubt, if Bob Mueller's investigation is thorough, that they will find Donald Trump has committed tax fraud. And by the way, you know, there are only two crimes that don't have a statute of limitations: murder and tax fraud.
Well, the assumption, just in closing, David K. Johnson, has always been that it also reveals connections to the Russians, since he was blackballed by Wall Street, couldn't raise money because he took too many banks down. Do you think that'll come out in Mueller's investigation?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, first of all, we have lots of public record of Donald doing deals with the Russians that were incredibly lucrative. Some of those deals make no economic sense unless they were payoffs in which Putin was trying to buy influence. And you have to think about this the way a world leader would think about it. It's like the way venture capitalists look at things. A venture capitalist will have 100 people propose ideas that they put money into. They expect 90 of them to lose all the money. They expect 5 of them to pay back what they put into it, and that's it. And they expect another 3 of them to produce a modest profit, and they expect 1 or 2 of them to make so much money, it's like, wow, look how rich we are. Let's go buy a bigger jet. And that's how Putin was operating. I have no doubt that Mueller is going to come up with many, many crimes by the people around Trump. And I anticipate that if he isn't shut down, we will see Donald Trump described as someone who is what I've called him for many years. He's a criminal. He just hasn't been indicted. The definition of a successful criminal is you don't get arrested.
And thank you very much for joining us here today, David.
Well, thank you for having me on.
And again, I've been speaking with David K. Johnson, an investigative journalist and winner of the Pulitzer Prize for Journalism, a longtime reporter for the New York Times and the former president of Investigative Reporters and Editors. He's the author of several New York Times bestsellers, including Perfectly Legal, Free Lunch, and The Fine Print. He's the co-founder and editor-in-chief of DCReport.org, and his latest book is The Making of Donald Trump. We're going to take a brief station break and back speaking with a Nevada gun violence prevention organizer who helped pass a background check law in Nevada that the Attorney General stymied. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Natalie Hernandez, who is a Nevada gun violence prevention organizer with Battleborn Progress. Welcome to Background Briefing, Natalie Hernandez.
Thank you so much.
And you took part in an effort to bring about background checks in the state of Nevada, and even though Nevada has some of the most lax gun laws in the country, and there's a lot of support in the rural counties for the NRA and for so-called gun rights, you'd still manage to get the state of Nevada to vote with you, right?
Correct.
Give us a sense of what was on the ballot, what was the question on the ballot, and what was the final numbers in terms of your victory?
So question one was the ballot initiative for background checks in Nevada. And basically what that looked like was that it would help expand the background check in Nevada, because currently the way that we do it is that it's just locally done. We have, but there's a lot of loopholes that people used to get around the background check. So background checks weren't required through private sales or through vendors at like gun shows, for example. And the background check initiative helped close those loopholes and also took it a step further by sending the background checks not only statewide, but to the FBI. Voters, it passed just by a hair, but it passed. It was what Nevada voters wanted, and it passed by, I want to say, 50.4% yes, and then a no was 49.6, so it literally passed just by a hair. But it is the law of the land, and it's something that we've been waiting to get enforced, and unfortunately it hasn't been yet.
And this passed back in November, but it's been held up by the state's attorney general, who is... He's a part of a kind of Republican dynasty there in the state, isn't he? He's the son of the former senator, close friend of Ronald Reagan's, Paul Laxalt.
Correct.
And how has this attorney general been able to thwart the will of the people?
Basically, since the initiative started coming up, Attorney General Adam Laxalt has been very vocal about his disapproval of the background checks. He's come out in various ads for both on radio and TV saying that he wasn't for background checks, and he even went as far as being a keynote speaker at the NRA this year actually, and even boasting about how he has not implemented the law so far. His excuse is that it's unenforceable, but currently there are 18 other states in the country that are doing what we are trying to do here in Nevada, so I refuse to take no as an answer, and I'm sure that he can find a way to help enforce the law that Nevadans voted for.
Well, it's no secret that Adam Laxalt is a supporter of the NRA. He spoke at the NRA's annual meeting this year, and he was introduced by the NRA's chief lobbyist as ensuring that Nevada's new background checks laws for private sales on what's known as the secondary market will not be the law of the land. So clearly the NRA are worried about the initiative that you helped to get passed.
Yeah, of course, because it'll affect their gun sales at the end of the day, and that's something that they don't want. They just want money in their pockets, and unfortunately our Attorney General is siding with them instead of siding with the safety and the lives of Nevadans.
And he's running for the governorship in 2018, is he not?
Yeah, he has all but announced his run for governor as of, in the wake of the shooting that happened on Sunday night, Monday morning. He has pushed back his official announcement, but we all know that that's what he's planning on doing, unfortunately. And he's lining his pockets with his special interest groups like the NRA that line his pockets.
So what is the reading then in terms of has there been a mood change since the horrible shooting on Sunday night?
I definitely feel it. I want to say that my fellow Nevadans have felt it also. This is something that we've been scared and haunted with for a long time, the possible disaster that could happen on the Strip and what that would look like. And unfortunately, we have experienced that now. I don't think people understand just how lax Nevada's gun laws are, and that's something that we've been pushing and advocating for and informing our community, is educating the public on just how relaxed Nevada's gun laws are. And now that they know that our own attorney general isn't enforcing the law of the land, a lot of heat is on him right now, because we don't know if any laws could have stopped this gun person from committing what he did on Sunday night. But if something is there in place to help keep Nevada safer, why not enforce it? And unfortunately, we know that Attorney General Adam Blackwell is not enforcing it because he's friends with the NRA.
And again, I'm speaking with Natalie Hernandez, who's a Nevada gun violence prevention organizer with Battle Born Progress. And she and her organization were successful in passing a background check law back in November that has been held up by the Nevada's Attorney General, Adam Laxalt, and has not been implemented. And clearly, I think you'll have some political wind at your back, although the president today was in Nevada speaking before a hospital staff, and also then later before law enforcement, local law enforcement. He was asked by a reporter about gun control becoming an issue now in the wake of this horrible shooting, which is widely reported as the worst mass shooting in modern American history. And Trump quickly said, this is not the time to talk about gun control. And that is, of course, the mantra of the Congress people in the pocket of the NRA, all of whom are offering prayers, but they don't want to talk about gun control. And they try to suggest that somehow the time is not right and it's inappropriate at this moment, that we should mourn. So what's your feeling about that? I mean, it seems so illogical that if you really care about people who have died at the hands of this shooter, then the best thing you could do is make sure that there are no more mass shootings like this, so that more innocent lives are lost.
Exactly. This rhetoric that right now is not the time, that we need to mourn. After assassinating all the children in Connecticut, the families in San Bernardino, LGBTQ community in Orlando, Aurora, and now in Las Vegas, when is the time? All these shootings keep happening, and all these mass deaths keep happening, not including all the daily deaths that happen because of gun violence. I think exactly right now is the time to bring it up and to fight for gun safety, comprehensive gun control, and educating the public exactly on what that means, because we're not trying to take people's guns away. We're trying to make our country, our state, safer.
Well, the secondary market, which basically not a lot of, it's not often discussed, frankly, even amongst gun control advocates. You know, when you talk about background checks and gun safety, as it's now often referred to, laws. I don't know that too many people have ever addressed this so-called secondary market at gun shows and private gun dealers, etc., where enormous amount of gun sales go on. I don't know what the statistics. Do you know what the statistics are about the secondary market, which is completely unregulated, as opposed to the gun shop market, where there are at least, they have to fill out a form that the FBI checks on?
Unfortunately, we don't have any concrete numbers on that, for the same reason that, like you mentioned, it's unregulated. It's something that we've been looking into for a long time to try to see if we can get some type of information on, but it's so hard to do so because so many private sales just happen, and unfortunately that's one of the loopholes that people use to get access to dangerous firearms.
Right, but didn't your initiative that passed in November in the state of Nevada close that loophole?
Right. It would have closed that loophole, which unfortunately, like we mentioned, Adam Laxalt has refused to enforce.
Right. Well, I understand that up to 40% of all guns sold in this country are sold through the secondary market, either at gun shows or over the internet. So that's the number that I'm getting. That's from 2015, but I'm sure it's pretty, current. Or if knowing how things are, it's probably even worse than 40% at the moment. So we don't know where this shooter in Las Vegas got all of his guns, do we? A couple of gun stores have indicated they sold some of the guns, but he had 42 in total, many of which had that bumper stock that allows it to fire fully automatic. That in itself is pretty extraordinary, isn't it, that that's legal?
Yes. I think it's crucial to examine all the policy issues that are implicated in the Las Vegas tragedy. But as far as we know, all the firearms that the shooter had were obtained in a legal way.
So will this all come down to the next election in 2018, where Adam Laxalt, the Attorney General, is running for governor? Won't this be a referendum on him? I mean, he's got to be a little defensive. Has anybody in the press there asked him about why he's held up this law and the implications of holding up this law, how it might have affected the ability to interdict this shooter? Although I'm not sure that necessarily it could have made a difference with this character. But in general, it's clearly a move in the right direction, and everything that else that that Adam Laxalt stands for and the NRA stands for is clearly a move in the wrong direction.
Correct. All of this is definitely going to come back and hurt Adam Laxalt's campaign, because he waited until something so tragic, unfortunately, happened for him to start acting. And he had all this time from when voters asked for this initiative to take place until now. And as far as I know, he hasn't actually come out with an actual response as to if he's going to start implementing it now or not. But there's a lot of heat on his back right now for him to answer to that, because it's a measure that could have helped at the end of the day. And it's a measure that could have helped save lives. And it will help save lives in the future when it is implemented.
Right, but if you manage to pass this background check law in a state that's big on so-called gun rights and it's largely unregulated in terms of gun sales, and you're able to close this important loophole in the secondary market of gun shows and over the internet, and the NRA, it's got the NRA's attention, and they're very, very concerned about it. So if you were able to pass it even narrowly in that state, isn't that an indicator that there's a chance in 2018 to vote these characters out, like Laxalt? I know the Republican senator there is vulnerable. He's not even particularly liked by Trump. and I imagine the Democrats are going to make an effort to get take that seat. So give us a reading on the broader issues, because at the end of the day, that seems to be the only solution, is if people who don't obey the law are public officials, they ought to be punished. And the only way we can do it in our democracy is to vote them out.
Yeah, definitely. 2018 is a big year for us in Nevada, and we have already started going after people like Dean Heller and Adam Laxalt for a while now, because just in the presidential election, we helped turn this state blue. And I think, like we had mentioned, with passing of the ballot initiative, even if it was within a hair, we still managed to pass that. And it definitely gives you a sense of how Nevadans are feeling. And we're tired of all the killings. We're tired of people dying. And now it's happening in our own backyards. And we're definitely going to go after the people that are responsible for that and make sure that they don't have those seats next year. Or, for example, Adam Laxalt have the governor's seat. We're going to put people in place that listen to Nevadans, or that enforce the laws that Nevadans put into place and voted for. And we're going to elect people that stand with Nevadans, not against them.
But meanwhile, gun shows continue, and I take it that the reason why this character was able to get 23 guns in and long guns, military-style weapons, into his hotel room at the Mandalay Bay Hotel was because of people. It's an open carry state, right? I mean, carry.
Right, it's open carry and concealed carry state. So he was able to, again, everything he did up to the point of shooting and starting to kill people was legal in Nevada.
Mm-hmm. So nobody at the hotel raised any kind of alarm that somebody was bringing 23 military-style weapons into his hotel room?
I know private-owned facilities have the power to declare a gun-free zone, which at this current time I'm not sure if the casino was a gun-free zone. But again, up until the point that he started shooting, as far as we know, everything that he had done was legal in the state of Nevada.
Right, and the only place where you can't open carry or conceal carry are federal buildings and schools, right, in the state?
Correct. Mm-hmm.
So just in closing then, this really is a rural-urban divide, is it? This issue of gun safety versus gun rights?
Again, I think we've proven our power here in Nevada, and we've voted to implement common sense gun laws. I don't think it's so much a divide of rural versus the cities, because a lot of rural counties are with us in common sense gun control. And I think especially after the shooting that happened right in our own backyard, a lot more people are going to start coming on board. I think it's just a lack of education and the fact that people don't know, again, that how relaxed Nevada's gun laws are. Because as soon as you start talking to people and letting them know how relaxed Nevada's gun laws are, they're shocked. In the wake of all these shootings that have taken place within the last few years, the death toll just keeps rising for all these mass shootings, not including the daily shootings that happen. Even just here in Nevada, Nevada is ranked third worst for women dying at the hands of a partner through a shooting. And that's not a good statistic to be on, especially as a woman in Nevada. So educating the community is our first task, and then engaging them and making sure that they're active in so we can pass common sense gun laws is the ultimate step.
Well, Natalie Hernandez, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Natalie Hernandez, who is a Nevada gun violence prevention organizer with Battle Born Progress. She was a part of a coalition of gun safety activists who managed to pass an initiative in Nevada back in November that closed loopholes in the secondary market for guns, which is completely unregulated. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.